This is the UVic Military Oral History Program with Captain Terry Swan, recorded on March 12, 2012, at Captain Swan's office, interviewed by Camus Erickson. Captain Swan, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
And can you please begin by just stating your full name?
Terrence David Swan.
Wonderful. So, let's begin with a question. So, what were your reasons for enlisting?
You know, I just always wanted to be in the Army, and that was, I suppose maybe it was just the time and the place I grew up, but it was something that I had no doubt that I would always do three things. I wanted to be an officer in the Army, I wanted to be a paratrooper, and I wanted to be a lawyer. So I probably set my sights too low, but that is what I had planned as a young man, what I wanted to do. So I did it.
Yeah, you accomplished
it. I wanted to be in the infantry. So as a young man, I joined the cadets. And went off, you know, to the militia, and then went off to the regular officer training plant. And the university got paid for by the military. And then I went off and joined the Line Regiment, Royal Canadian Regiment, and from there the Airborne Regiment. There we go.
What actions brought you towards the Canadian Airborne?
I wanted to get out of Petawawa.
Oh.
I was stationed in Petawawa in Ontario, and I didn't like it. It was, you know, like remote.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like 100 miles north of Ottawa, and I just wanted to get back west because I was a Westerner. So part of the reason I went to the Airborne Regiment was so I could move to Edmonton, plus the fact it was an adventurous regiment.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like the unit I was with, but I thought that it accomplished two things. Get me to do a bit of parachuting, and also get me back to Edmonton to the west.
Careful. Definitely did that, didn't you? So, what was your rank upon deployment to Cyprus?
I was a captain. Army captain.
Mm-hmm. And before you left for Cyprus, did you receive any, like, extra training?
Not really, because it was very quick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, as I recall, we were in the Mojave Desert, the whole regiment, and we got sent back to Canada because we were going to go somewhere, Egypt, I think. I can't remember where it was. And then the Russians said, no, you can't have combat troops there. So that trip got canceled. So we flew back to the Mojave Desert. We painted our vehicles white, painted our helmets white. We weren't going. We painted our helmets brown. We painted our vehicles brown. And then I guess out of sympathy, the Army felt like they wanted to give the Airborne Regiment some operational experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they were probably running short of other soldiers anyways because they had seen so many tours. So they said, well, let's send the Airborne Regiment over to Cyprus instead of a normal line regiment. But it was too big to send the whole lot, so they just sent half. And that was, you know, one commando and some of the other support units.
Mm-hmm. So
but in terms of training for us, when the Turkish invasion happened, we didn't get any training.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you're going to Cyprus, boys. Meet in 12 hours here. So, like, I had an apartment on the base. I had my car. They said, drive your cars here, park them there in the compound, and leave the keys here, and we'll lock everything. We'll load it up for you in storage. And, like, that was it. We were gone. And they said, oh, by the way, you know, meet over there, and we'll paint the helmets white again. And we didn't take any vehicles with us. So we mm-hmm. got all our gear, painted our helmets white, or blue, I guess it was, and in like very short period of time we were off in Germany and then from Germany to Cyprus. So it was a very short period of time. So really there was a lot of training, and I think, you know, what there was though is that when the Army does deploy, you've got those administrative skills that you've already got from being in the Army. You know, you've got the organization, you've got the infrastructure, you've got the aircraft support, you've got all the weaponry and vehicles and the system to bring a massive number of people to a different location without really missing a beat. So even though we weren't really trained in UN operations, we were trained to work as a group and, you know, do what the political masters said to do. So I think, you know, it was a well-trained unit.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had an experience in a combat area before?
Well, at first, I don't think Cyprus was really a combat area,
mm-hmm.
but the closest I came was the FLQ crisis when we were in Petawawa, and then we got deployed to Montreal, like on Thanksgiving. Okay, boys, we're going to Montreal. This is a real thing. That's what my company commander said. So we had a fan out. You know, you get on the phone, you phone your three section commanders, the section commanders phone all their soldiers and say, everybody, meet down at the drill hall. You know, bring your gear, full bug out. We're going to the FLQ crisis. So off we went to Ottawa and then to Montreal, and that was like 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that ended up being more like a police action. There's no real combat, but it was a quick organizational thing. Then the other thing was that we were involved in the Millhaven Penitentiary escape, so we were out looking for crazy prisoners in Millhaven, close to Kingston, not shortly thereafter that. They called up the army to hunt down the prisoners.
When was that?
I guess I'd been about maybe 70, 71-ish. Yeah, I think it was after the FLQ crisis. And then from there I went to the Airborne Regiment.
So in your previous interview, you said that you were sent to Cyprus in response to the Turkish invasion, of course. What were you told about the situation before you left? Were you told anything about...
The Turks are invading.
Yeah.
We got to go and join the rest of the unit.
That's what you're told?
Let's get ready. I mean, you know, there's always lots of briefings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people, they try to brief you all the time so you know what's going on. But I don't specifically remember what we were told, but we were probably told... The Turks have invaded. You got to reinforce the regiment. We're leaving, you know, in 36 hours. Get your gear together. You know, here's all the administrative stuff you have to do. We probably had a briefing at the drill hall to say, you know, here's what the Turks wear. Here's the color of their berets. I think they told us that the airborne troops in Turkey had blue berets like the UN troops.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to be careful there. We had learned some basic words like dur, stop in Turkish, and stanata, I think, in Greek. And, you know, that we didn't know what was going to happen, but our job would be to go to Nicosia in CANCON and reinforce the rest of the regiment and probably carry out our UN mandate, which I'll tell you about when you ask me that question. So, I mean, it wasn't too specific because, you know, I don't think anybody really even knew because
mm-hmm.
in those days you didn't have Twitter and you didn't have emails or anything. I mean, I never talked to anybody in Canada the whole 6 months I was there. You know, wrote the odd letter and that's it. There was no phones, just that you couldn't phone Canada.
Mm-hmm.
There was no emails. So you just, okay, I'm off. See you in 6 months.
And even letters take a while to get places.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So were you not told about the sort of Greek coup that sort of sparked the invasion? Were you told about that at all?
You know, we may have been, but, you know, I don't think soldiers are that interested in the political aspects of it. Okay, we're going to Cyprus, get your gear. When and when we're coming back, you know, our job is to look after the OPs on the Green Line, and you know, we've got these observation posts. So, I mean, I think there was probably, you know, some briefings about the political situation, but you got to remember, at our level, we're talking, you know, privates, 18, 19 years old. I was a lieutenant, or I guess as a captain, then I think I was 26. So, I mean, none of us had PhDs in political science. Like, we were just soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And we were said, we're going to Cyprus. We're going to get in between the Greeks and the Turks and try and, you know, maintain the distance. And the rest of it, for the most part, wasn't that political. I mean, commanding officer was a major. He was probably 30, you know. So, you know, I don't think we got too involved in that, at least at our level. Maybe they did more at the UN headquarters and they did at the Canadian headquarters for the UN, but at my level, which was right down, I guess, you know, what they call it, like the boots, we're just too busy trying to get organized about her off because we were going away for, we didn't know how long.
Of course.
So we just backed up and took off.
Mm-hmm. So what was the Canadian Airborne and I guess the UN's mandate in Cyprus?
The Airborne Regiment, I don't think, had a mandate, so to speak, except do what you're told. Do it good, but the UN mandate, which it's called UNFACYP, United Nations Force in Cyprus. So it was originally defined as in the interest of preserving international peace and security, to use its best efforts to prevent a recurrence of fighting and, as necessary, contribute to the maintenance and restoration of law and order and return to normal conditions. That was the mandate that when we got there. Then, after the second phase of the Turkish invasion, it was expanded, and it said that it went on to increase that to make sure that the ceasefire lines and the buffer zone were established and not breached. So that's basically what our job was to do. We weren't there for combat. We were there to keep the two factions apart, to try and, you know, promote peace and, you know, stopping the two warring factions. And in addition to that, I think, you know, we were tasked with humanitarian assistance. You know, like putting refugees in one corner, and there was some food issues. And also another horrible job we had was we had to pick up the dead bodies, which were all like bloated. And so, you know, that we worked parties to do that when we first got there. So, you know, that wasn't a lot of fun. Anyway, that's basically what the mandate was. Ours was a UN mandate, and it would be the same as all the other contingents.
So you served as the platoon commander, and you were in charge of, I think you said in your previous mission, approximately 35 people?
Yeah, about 35 soldiers.
So what were your duties in that role?
Well, I mean, you're the platoon commander, you're the leader, you've got a platoon sergeant or a platoon warrant officer. The lieutenant or the captain commander leads the troops. The sergeant or warrant officer administers to the troops. So I would be responsible for placing the soldiers in the various OPs, the observation posts. Now, they were already pre-established, but we would make sure that, you know, they had the specific orders as to what to report, what to do, the orders for opening fire, to make sure that their weapons were properly sighted so that there was, you know, interlocking arcs. We would make sure that the rota was properly done, and basically be in charge of the sector I was given on those OPs and make sure that they were manned and the soldiers knew what was happening in front of them. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to brief them as, you know, here's the enemy situation. There's a thing called SMEAC. You may have situation, mission, execution, command and signals, you know, administration and logistics. So you'd always have these little orders groups with the soldiers when they go out to their OPs, and you'd say, here's the situation, the Turks have been, you know, using small arms fired up, pop off the light bulb over behind you, so make sure that blah, blah, blah. The mission, your mission is to maintain the buffer between the Turks and the Greeks and try and stop any sporadic firing that there might be by trying to negotiate with the other side to make sure that that stops, or at least report it so that, you know, higher headquarters can bring in a stronger force to try and negotiate that stopping of the ceasefire. You know, so that's the situation, that's the mission. You know, execution and logistic, you're going to be here for the next 12 hours. You know, how's your ammo, how's your weapons working? You've got water, do you have a night scope? Do you have your binoculars? Does the radio work? Have you got the batteries for the radio? Do you have a landline? Those are the sort of things that I would be in charge of for my platoon. And, you know, I'd have XOPs on the green line, and that's what my job was. The platoon sergeant's job was to make sure that all of the administration was done, so that the ammo was there, the rations and the quarters, and the petrol for the gas, for the vehicles. And then I had three section commanders, each who were corporals or sergeants, depending, and they had their 10 men. So they would probably have maybe three OPs or whatever each, and they would pair the same SMEAC that I told them, except at their level. They'd leave some things I left out, but they'd add in the things that were more important. So, you know, and that went on 24/7. So basically I would just tour around and, you know, make sure everything was okay, and if there was any issues, we'd deal with it. If there was any meetings required between the Turks and the Greeks, then the platoon commander would go and try, you know, talk to them and get an interpreter and say, okay, well, you got to move that gun because it's too close and you can't point it and you can't fire into the air and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it was a situation where you really tried to create a buffer between the two warring factions.
Mm-hmm. So what about compared to your duties working at the UN headquarters?
Well, I mean, when you're a platoon commander, you're at the front edge. I mean, you don't get much pointier than that, because that's where all the action is. And I did that for the first 3 months with two commando, and, you know, I had my own platoon. And then after, I guess, about halfway through, there was one of the engineer captains who was with the UN from the very beginning. He came over with the airborne regiment when they first deployed 3 months earlier. He, for some reason, had to go back to Canada, so they needed a replacement. So I got chosen to go up to UN headquarters in, as the Assistant Operations Information Officer. So my job there basically was I had a British sergeant and a British corporal working for me, and I worked for a British major. Our job was to brief the commander every morning on the whole situation on the whole island. If there was any redeployment of troops, if there was any redeployment of equipment, if there was any fights or any, you know, shooting or any fires or any refugee problems, or if the ICRC was having trouble getting into a certain area, then I had to brief the commander, or, you know, my major often did that, but when he wasn't around, I did it. But most of the time, the major did it. But he would do it from information that I provided through all the other contingents telling me, because they each had a contingent, and we had a Canadian guy who did that as well. So I meet with them, they tell me the situation in their area, and then I would brief the major, or I'd brief the, you know, the commander every morning at the morning briefing and tell them the situation so that they could then plan. Like if they thought there was trouble in this area, they may have to redeploy, or they may have to bring some political pressure. So you go from like right on the ground looking at the Turks and the Greeks from, you know, like 30 yards away, to being at a headquarters at Blue Beret Camp. I think it was called BBC, Blue Beret Camp. And, you know, you're working out of an office building, and, you know, we had civilians wandering around and UN types wandering around, you know, colonels and majors. And, you know, we had Wimpy Burgers, which was the equivalent of a hamburger, because the British had a canteen, and they had Wimpy Burgers. That's what they called them in those days. And the other thing, part of my job, which was a great part, I had to go out and see all the other contingents all throughout the island. So I got issued a car. I got issued a little Ford Focus or something. I got a picture of it. UN-144. And I got the keys, I got the car, and I could take that car anywhere I wanted, and I drove that thing everywhere. And also, the other good thing is I had a British helicopter on standby. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, you couldn't drive to Famagusta because the roads were screwed up and there was checkpoints and everything else. But we'd get clearance to go to all these other areas. So I was lucky enough to be able to travel through all of the island and meet the various other contingents. You know, like DanCon, I remember they'd always give me, you know, nice little cheese and ham sandwiches, and we'd have lunch, and, you know, they'd have some schnapps, and then you'd go over to the Finns, and they'd say, give you 3 fingers of vodka and take you to the sauna, you know. And then the Brits, they'd say, well, I don't know, let's go to the mess, and you would have a drink. And they were in the south, so there was a British air base there called RAF Nicosia. They called it Rafnik. There was a big sign on the wall I always liked that said, if God had wanted the army to fly, he would have painted the sky brown. So, you know, I mean, it was basically just liaising with the other individual contingent liaison officers. So I got a relationship with them, and they'd tell me what's going on, and I'd meet them, and they'd brief me, and they'd send reports in every day. So it was more of an informational thing, mm-hmm. so that we could brief the commander of what his response should be to any given situation.
Was there any danger in traveling, like driving around?
You know, we had quite a few times you'd go through checkpoints, mm-hmm. you know, and it was difficult because the Turks didn't understand English, and so you'd have to eventually get an officer. And usually once you got up to an officer level, a lot of Turks would speak English. You know, there'd be a lot of passes and whatnot and guys pointing guns at you, but I never had a firefight in any of those, and, you know, we got along okay. The only thing is, once, I think, when I was still with the commandos, somebody started mortaring our compound. Or no, I think the Greeks set up a mortar right beside our compound, and they were, you know, then everybody was saying, well, geez, if they're starting to mortar that, then the Turks are going to... So I was the guy, I got told by my major, you go out there and get rid of those guys. So I got a little patrol together, and we went out, and as we were coming down, bargained off in trucks and took off. But that was not the highlight of my action,
yeah.
Chasing the Greek mortar people off our property.
Could you describe sort of the atmosphere within Nicosia?
Well, it wasn't a party, because, you know, you don't... Like, we didn't get any leave, I don't think, for like 3.5 months. We just, like, worked. And I mean, people would carry on. I mean, you know, I wasn't there for the first phase, but obviously during the second phase, we were at our own camp. I'm sure the cities were like going to ground, you know, laying low. But it doesn't take people long, once the shelling and whatnot have stopped, to become very resilient, and they get back to work. I don't know why I had to deal with Black & Decker, but I had to deal with Black & Decker, the international office, about some equipment, and, you know, because they were big into tools in Europe, and the Eastern headquarters was in Nicosia. So I remember visiting Black & Decker, and, you know, like, you know, staff were all carrying on, and, you know, normal, and just get on with it. So I think, you know, the Greek Cypriots were always fighting about whether they wanted Enosis, which is union with Greece, or whether they wanted to be independent. So they were all scrap, scrap, scrap. Mm-hmm. And then when the Turks invaded, they forgot about that, and they just, you know, hated the Turks. So they all sort of got together in a bit of a union, and they, you know, they put all their energy against the Turks. But in terms of the city, you know, once the shelling and everything stops, they just carry on. They just carry on with normal life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Put the bricks back where they try to be, and, you know, clean up the debris, and can all try to make a dollar. That's what people do. Just get on with it.
Yeah. What about between the Turkish and Greek forces on either side of the Green Line? Was there tension there all the time?
Well, they tried to kill each other. That was the whole aim. The Turks, you know, they would shoot each other. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to kill each other. And, you know, so there'd always be sniping and shooting, and, you know, some guy set up a machine gun, and the other guy set up flares. I mean, I suppose you realize that two of the young Canadians got shot in that Jeep, you know, like, go figure. And some guy was just gun happy. It was probably a Cypriot, you know, like a Greek Cypriot who just, like, was a cowboy. Probably didn't see who it was. Could have been a Turk. I don't know who it was. But it was just unfortunate. So that was the point of the UN, try to keep these guys apart, because they would just spend all night sniping. I mean, all, you know, you could hear the shooting back and forth all night. But that was the job of the OPs, to try and stop that and negotiate with them to settle back and, you know, move their weapons back, or, you know, stop doing this or stop catcalling. And there was all this catcalling back and forth. You know, no, they didn't like each other. They were at war.
Mm-hmm, of course. Yeah. So did you ever experience a firefight when you were in Cyprus?
I guess, you know, like, we weren't, I was never involved in a firefight.
Mm-hmm, but in between ones.
You know, I guess that when they were bombing the grammar school and whatnot, you know, strafing all that, I guess that's about the closest. But I never got into a trench and, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of had to duck down because the bullets were going over my head. We were lucky, I guess. Some of the OPs had that problem. But my particular platoon escaped that, thank goodness.
Okay.
But I think one commando had a few where Coronado or a few of the other OPs were, you know, they're firing over them, and, you know, and they, those posts were abandoned eventually, because we were not there in a combat operation. We were there to keep these guys apart. So, you know, we could return the fire, but, you know, under certain limited circumstances, protection of yourself or people under your protection, or maybe protection of property. We got orders for opening fire, but, you know, pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, you know, a war. We were the UN guys, and we had to remain neutral. We had to promote peace. So that is a totally different role from what we had, you know, with the airborne regiment. Because in the airborne regiment, you know, it's a very aggressive, you know, sort of special force to go in, and, you know, you normally would jump in and secure areas so the main force could then come in a day or two later. So you had to take off your airborne hat.
Oh, you brought it.
And you had to put on your UN hat. So when we got off the plane in Cyprus, we were all wearing our airborne hats. Blue and berets. But then, like, okay, boys, get rid of those hats and put on your UN hat. So, you know, like, it was a total mindset change from being in the airborne regiment to wearing the blue beret.
Was it sort of strange to be in that role when you were?
Oh, yeah, it was strange because we were used to, you know, being sort of the elite soldiers, and now we're in a peacekeeping role, and nobody really knew what it, you know, like, you're sort of useless. You can't really do much when you've got like 900 soldiers in Cyprus spread over a long area of the Green Line, like two or three old people at each OP. You got, like, I think there was like 30,000 or 40,000 Turks and however many Greeks. You can't stop people,
mm-hmm.
but you can try and negotiate and keep people advised and, you know, at the local level, try and reduce the stress, try and reduce the, you know, the anger, and keep the sides apart. Mm-hmm. Some people are better, others weren't. You know, I mean, there's a lot of negotiation, a lot of negotiation. And the thing is, the Western world, you sit down, you start negotiating. It's a bit different than Turkey. You know, you sit down and you have to have a coffee, and then you've got to, you know, make sure everybody's seated right. You got to have all the people in place, and then after the niceties, then you start talking. But you don't just start talking right away. You got to sort of understand their cultural norms, and the Greek cultural norm is different from the Turk cultural norm. You know, the Turks are very sort of you know, structured, whereas, you know, the Mediterranean Greeks, you know, they tend to get a little bit more excited, particularly the Greek Cypriots, who weren't really, they weren't really an organized army. They were like, you know, okay, Minuteman,
mm-hmm, like militia.
Yeah.
Were you involved in the retaking of Nicosia?
No, I wasn't. That wasn't anything to do with us, but I don't even know if the Canadians retook it. I think it was a negotiated arrangement, which in one of my books it set out, I think, I forget the name of the Canadian that negotiated it, but I think it was more of a negotiated leaving the airport rather than, we didn't like really fight to retake it, but I wasn't involved in it.
Okay. I remember you mentioning it in your other interview, and I was wondering if you were actually there.
Yeah. No.
So can you describe sort of your encounters with Turkish and Greek soldiers?
Well, it was all negotiation of it, really. You know, you really wouldn't so much deal with the soldiers. Because the Turkish soldiers, I mean, if you said to a Turkish soldier, start running that way, he would run until he was dead, because that's what they did. It was absolute discipline. Whereas the Greeks were a little bit more casual about that. So if there was a situation where you had to negotiate, usually you'd get the officers. And most officers could actually speak English. So most of the negotiation would be in English. You know, most of them would talk, and, you know, you'd sort of just try and diffuse the situation, and you'd have a coffee and chat, and you'd sit in the middle and, you know, shake hands. And but, you know, the officers were quite reasonable, and they realized that, you know, they weren't going to be, you know, making a big push, because they, that wasn't their orders.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a question of keeping everything at a low level, a low key, and trying to diffuse any local tension that came up. But, you know, the soldiers didn't have any contact with each other, and it was probably illegal, because you can't fraternize with the enemy. You'd probably get shot if you did.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could meet in a neutral ground with the officers, it usually got resolved. And if it didn't, then you'd escalate. You'd get your major, you know, and then the colonel would get involved, and it, you know, would become a bit more of a high-level negotiations, and then it would filter down again.
But overall, you saw sort of a respect for the UN presence.
I'm not sure if I saw that or not.
Yeah.
I think the Turks probably respected. I don't think the Greeks did as much. Yeah, I wouldn't want to, I don't know. I wouldn't think that. Well, the UN is a bit toothless, you know. There's nothing that she could do, but that was the mandate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that there's some articles I read that saying that, you know, there's no point in increasing the UN troops because you can't do anything anyway. You know, there's sort of a. It's a good concept, and that's a great idea. But when you've got two warring armies, they're not going to worry about a couple of OPs in the middle. So I think there was a reasonable amount of respect, but I wouldn't think it was a lot of respect. I think that, you know, the Greeks like to serve for the economy, you know, because we would spend money on food and rations and petrol and gas. And, you know, I think that it became an economic benefit having the UN there to Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if politically the Greeks really appreciated us, and I don't think the Turks even crossed their mind. They never, you know, I think, sure, some individual Turks would respect certain UN officers because they stood up to them and negotiated the airport return, and there was a time where the Turks said to the Turkmenate, you have to leave, you have to get out of these areas, and we just wouldn't. We said, no, well, if you come out, we're going to return the fire. No, they never did come, and so they, you know, we stood up to them, and they probably respected that because they didn't do anything, you know, smile and shake hands and salute and carry on.
So had you ever been to Cyprus prior to?
No, never been to Kypros.
No?
Nope.
Yeah, I was would be interesting to get sort of a comparison. Have you ever been back?
I haven't, but a lot of my friends have been back, and they say it's totally different. I mean, they got freeways, and it's like the nightclub of England, I think. There's a lot of nightclubs, a lot of sort of party places. And I guess it's just been very westernized. A lot of Brits, a lot of Germans.
Do you think from the UN presence?
No, I think it's probably just cheap land, you know, cheap accommodation. Close to Europe, you can fly there, you know, and, you know, it's like going to Rimini in Italy, where big party town, you know, or Monaco. It's probably like a cheap man's Monaco. Now, you know, people will go to Egypt because they've got these sort of, and Mexico, you know, they've got these enclaves. You wouldn't want to go to anywhere in Mexico except that little gated area. Well, I think that Cyprus was probably the forerunner of a lot of those places for Europeans, because you've got, what, 400 million Europeans over there, and it's always hot, sunny, you know, beautiful beaches. So that was their party island. That's what I've heard from a couple of fellows who've been back. I haven't been back. I'd probably be disappointed, because I remember it as quite rural, you know, and still very sort of idyllic in many ways.
Untouched by the Western man. Yes. So when you worked at the headquarters, did you ever notice any political interventions sort of between maybe American and...
Well, no, because we didn't have any Americans and Russians there. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a totally different level. They were all the aircraft carriers somewhere. I don't think there was any Americans. The only American president I saw in Cyprus was... we were in Akrotiri, which is a British air base, and I saw a U-2 land there. And then I saw it take off a couple hours later. And the U-2 was one of those spy planes with the big wide wings, and it came down like a corkscrew, and I guess it must have, I don't know, did whatever it did at Akrotiri, sent pictures off or whatever. Then it took off again. So we knew it was American U-2, because nobody else had U-2s. But I mean, I think, you know, if you look at behind the scenes, you know, the Americans and the British and the Russians, I mean, they're all plying for the Mediterranean control. The British weren't that involved, but the Americans had the 7th Fleet and the Russians had their fleet. You know, and I think Macarius was anti-communist, Sampson was pro-communist, and then Clarides was sort of trying to be neutral. But it was a time where Russian expansionism was big. They wanted to have, you know, that supply route for their Mediterranean fleet. They wanted to take control of it. So it was a big fight between the Americans and the Russians in the Cold War. But nothing came of it, obviously. Mm-hmm. The Russians got outspent in the Cold War by Reagan, and they lost.
True. So what is your opinion of how the UN handled the situation? Do you think they could have...
Well, you know, again, the UN is a long way away in New York. You know, and soldiers think nothing worse than some guy micromanaging from New York to try and say, do this or do that. But at my level, I didn't experience any of that. Especially at the platoon commander level, I mean, we didn't experience any of that. Except one incident, which I'll tell you about. And even at the UN headquarters, I didn't find any political interference. Because we were so far removed from the UN headquarters, at least I was, that it never really affected me. But we did have one soldier in 2 Commando. I don't think he was... He might have been in our company. He was from a Greek origin. You know, he was a Greek-Canadian. And he spoke Greek. And so one of his uncles was one of the Greek generals on the island. So we used to always get permission. We used to... The Greek general would say, I want to see my nephew, and I want to take him on such and such a place, and I want to take him here and there, and, you know, and was saying, this does not really maintain the neutrality we're supposed to maintain if our Greek private is supping with his Greek general. If Turks find out about that, you know, this is not going to be a happy scene. So that was the only thing which I think got resolved at a much higher level than us. But that was an interesting sort of conflict that we had. Mm-hmm. Because originally, we used to use this chap as a translator. Because we'd say, okay, what'd he say, you know? And he sort of got known. And then I guess my uncle contacted him, or he contacted the uncle. So that was the only sort of political interference we had. And that was out 2 Commando level.
So what is your opinion of Canada's media coverage of the Cyprus situation?
Well, I think it's pretty limited. I mean, you know, tell me this and tell me that, kick him out the brute. What does he say to the country when the guns begin to shoot? And I mean, let's face it, in that time, in that era, Canada was into peacekeeping. Like, they weren't into war fighting. They didn't have Bosnia, they didn't have Afghanistan. Everybody's forgotten about Korea. The liberals were in power, and it was a very anti-war, pro-peace, you know, environment. So I think the press just didn't want to talk about it because it didn't sell papers and nobody was interested. So, you know, I've got that clipping from the Saskatoon Star Phoenix where it says that the troops have settled into the quarters. I think when we came back from Edmonton, they might have had something in the paper, you know, the Airborne Regiment returns. But it wasn't front and center. And if somebody got killed or there was a big casualty, yeah, there'd be an article in the paper. But you look back even to the war in Afghanistan, you know, 129 Canadians killed there, I think, and in Cyprus it was like two killed. It wasn't even in combat. It was like, you know, just stupid shootings. I think the press was pretty liberal in those days, that the less they said in there about the military, the better. So I don't think we got much coverage at all. In fact, you ask the average Canadian, and they can't even spell Cyprus. They had no idea how to spell it. So, it wasn't front and center in Canadian politics. It was okay, they're over there, whatever. You know, you got then 20 million Canadians and 1,000 over in Cyprus. You know, like Trudeau said, if they want to see the world, they should, if soldiers want to see the world, they should buy a ticket and pay for it like every other Canadian. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the attitude, I think. So I don't think there's a lot of press.
No. Do you wish there had been?
Well, you know, you can't really, I would say it doesn't really make a lot of difference.
Yeah,
there isn't. I mean, because we never really functioned on what press we got. We tried to function as a regiment, you know, like, and that's part of the problem with the Army. They stick so close together, they're so tight, you know, it's like the RCMP are tight, and the Army's tight, you know, and the regiments are tight. So they don't care so much about public opinion because nobody liked the Army in those days anyways, you know, because it was like just after Vietnam and, you know, the Army was bad and peace was good. So I don't think most soldiers paid a lot of attention to that. And I didn't, quite honestly. I mean, I think I decided to get out of the Army when I was in Cyprus. So, and partly it's because when I did see the grammar school getting bombed by those jets and I saw these Greek Cypriots driving up there, I sort of did realize the futility of it all. You know, like, what's the point of this? Because we can't control what's happening. Somebody else is controlling what we have to do at a higher level. And I think there's a general consensus that, like, why are we over here busting our butt when the Greeks don't really care that much anyways? You could probably draw the parallel with Afghanistan now. Like, why are they there, you know, getting killed? Because the minute they leave, you know, what good has it done? It's a 1,000 years of culture, and it's pretty tough to go in, like, in the Western world. Okay, we're here 20 years, everything's fixed, so we're going away now. You know, it just goes right back to the way it was. So that's about it, I think, for that answer.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the Canadian Airborne Regiment was needed? Do you think if they weren't there, the situation would have just gone as it had?
Oh, I don't think it would have made any difference if it was the M1 Regiment or the Bandus or the Royal Canadian Regiment or the CLI. They're all trained in the same way. I think it would have been exactly the same result because it wouldn't matter what unit was there. As long as it's a Canadian unit, they all do a good job. Mm-hmm. So, no, I don't think it makes any difference.
So what memories have stuck with you the most? Are there some situations that have stayed with you more than others?
I think probably the first thing when I got off the plane in, I think it was Akrotiri, when we came from Germany, first thing they did was issue us live ammo. That was sort of like, okay, I guess we're here, you know. So you get off the plane, you get your gear, there's a guy at the ammo point, you know, here's your ammunition, load up. You know, so that was a bit of a shock because you know you're getting live ammo because you know that you're somewhere where it's different from Edmonton. The other thing I remember is we didn't have any fridges for months because it's no electricity. So we used to drink the yogurt because it was so soft, you know, like you drink it like milk. So we used to get British yogurt, or maybe it was Italian, but Yoplait, I think it was. And you just take the top off and drink it because you couldn't spoon it out because it was all melted. The other thing that was interesting was the British made our bread. So we get bread from the Brits, from, like I said, a big kitchen somewhere, and wherever it was, maybe at the air base. And the bread was in a white, sort of a wax paper container, and it had stripes all around the bread, going around, like, you know, all around the outside edge. And there, every stripe, every day was a different color. So red would say Monday, yellow Tuesday, green Wednesday. So you know how old the bread was because of the color of the stripe. And so it was sort of neat, I thought.
Yeah.
But the problem is if it was Friday and you got Thursday's bread, you knew it was, you know, because it was hot there. I mean, it was hot. So things would like dry right out. And there was no air conditioning, no power for fridges or anything like that. I also remember the refugees, you know, I do remember them wandering around, and like, I remember feeling sorry for all the people in the north, because they were just basically, they were kicked out, you know, they've probably been there for 1,000 years, and the Turks just gone. Mm-hmm. And Famagusta was a city on the east side of Cyprus, which was completely destroyed. I mean, we see like pigs and dogs running around, and you know, people looking for little bits of food. I got there when I was there on with the helicopter, but we stopped for, you know, part of the day there, and that was sad to see the refugees, you know, who didn't have anything, no power, no food, and the Turks were there. You know, I'm sure that they weren't always treated the best, so that was sad to see. And I guess that's pretty much it. I remember some good things, because after 3 months we got some leave and we got to go to a nice hotel.
Oh yeah.
And I had some nice coffee. And you know, you met other countries, and you know, you got to chat away. I mean, you know, other soldiers from other countries. But that was good. I look back with fond memories on Cyprus, you know. It was also funny, I think we were supposed to come home like on the 19th of December, but the Air Force like works on its own time, so everybody's all packed up, we're all set to go, we're all loaded up, and you get a message, plane's delayed 48 hours. So that you just can't let everybody go on their own, because everybody's got their liquor, their duty free 40 ounces, so you don't want to let 1,000 guys each have a 40 ounce duty free, so you'd have to quickly organize sports parades, you know, and movies and you know, shows where you had to get everybody organized. You couldn't just sort of say, okay, you know, we'll see everybody in 2 days, because it'd be a nightmare. You know, they'd just be chaos. So right away you had to then go with plan two. Okay, you know, we're going to do cleaning weapons for the first hour, then we got sports parade for 3 hours, and you're doing that, and you're doing that, you're doing that. And now we're going to put on a skit. You guys are doing this skit, and you guys are doing that. Who plays the piano? Okay, well, you get over there. You know, so you're all of a sudden scrambling for the 2 days to get people organized so that they're not, you know, boozing it up with their 40 ounces. And so that was a bit of a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, you know, some guys, some of the officers I knew, and I'm sure the soldiers as well, they had children while they didn't, but their wives had children while they're in Cyprus. And, you know, they didn't even know what the child looked like, because there was no internet or anything like that. You know, you might send a picture, but they hadn't seen their children for, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 months after they were born. So they actually got priority to go home first a lot of those. So that was good. You know, so they got home a couple of days early. And then all the vehicles had to go back by ship. So some people volunteered to go back by ship, you know, to look after the vehicles, because you needed a driver and you needed an officer to organize it, you know, all the customs and the papers. But there's a few volunteers for that, and so they went back on freighters, and the rest of us flew back by Germany. And in those days, there was no R&R, like, okay, you're in Germany, we're leaving in an hour, and going back to Edmonton, okay, boys, you've got a month off, see ya. That was it. No debriefings or anything. At least I don't recall any.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty much the extent of my recollection of Cyprus.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one last thing that sort of came up with my interview with Tim and Ross.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted me to ask you if you knew what danger is no stranger to an airborne ranger.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Do you recall that?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Danger is no stranger to the airborne ranger. Or it's jump or do you mind the drop? No, it's just a sudden stop. And then, how far are you going to go, jumper? All the way. But Cam was the same rank as me when he was in the Lord Strathcona. Yeah, I got out of the Army, but we've kept up a bit of a relationship. And I think he retired as a one-star or two-star general.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and he's moved here now, which is great.
Yeah, he lives in Oak Bay.
Oh, does he? I don't even know where he lives, and I live in Oak Bay.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I should get his address. I saw him the other day at the thing, you know, the Roosie thing, but we were chatting away. But maybe we'll go golfing someday. We probably both like to golf.
You can send you his contact information.
Yeah, I should get that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, no, Cyprus was a good experience. I mean, pretty much all of us came out unscathed. There was no such thing as PTSD or anything like that. You just, okay, we're back home, boys. Clean them up. Don't leave. Turn your weapons in. Clean them up. Let's go. And then you come back and, all right, we're going to Wainwright for 3 weeks out of training exercise, or we're going somewhere else. So you just get back into the routine, and, you know, and then everybody talks about it. That was sort of the big operation until Bosnia, you know, and then Bosnia has now been sort of taken over by Afghanistan. So the vets used to talk about Cyprus. Now they're talking about Afghanistan and Bosnia and whatnot. Keeps the Army going. It gives them some operational training.
So, do you have anything more to add before we conclude?
Well, I think it's a credit to, you know, the Canadian Army that they were able to switch roles like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I attribute that to good leadership. You know, in Cyprus there was none of this, like, shooting civilians and running amok and having, you know, Confederate flags flying around like happened subsequent with the Airborne Regiment. So, you know, you got to give all the officers and the senior NCOs credit for, you know, commanding that regiment in a proper manner. So that's my only comment. At that point in time, you know, you'd probably be with the regiment. Anyways, there we go. And
wonderful.
So, I had a good time and still, you know, have sort of good memories of Cyprus, but they're fading. So it's a good thing that you got me when you did.
Yeah.
Because if you ask me what a bottle of Aphrodite wine would cost, I don't know, but I think it was a quarter.
So, was it good wine?
No.
No?
Cheap flonk, but... Anyway.
All right. Well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Captain Terry Swan on March 12, 2012. Now, while the tape is running, I'm just going to get you to look over the interview release form.
Well, I'm not signing any damn release.
Say something you don't want people to know.
I don't get trailer fee or anything like that, you know, for, I'm waiving my rights to all my royalties.
Oh.
Sort of operation is it?
I don't
even get free parking at U of A. C A M A S.
I'm bringing up with my professor.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll change that.
R I K
S S O N.
S O N. 12 March. 12. Signed, sealed, and delivered.
Wonderful. So, just for formalities, we have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Perfect. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Tamas. You did a great job.
Well, thank you.